Welcome back. Solomon Burke, King Solomon. They called him the Bishop of Soul. And Jerry Wexler, executive at Atlantic Records, said that Solomon Burke was the greatest soul singer of all time. I saw Solomon Burke sing at a beautiful concert venue here in Toronto called Massey Hall. And this isn't too long before Solomon passed away. A big man, to say the least. By this time, he must have weighed probably close to 400 pounds, and he was performing sitting down. And at one point, he put his microphone down. He didn't need it. His voice filled the theater. Such a powerful, powerful voice. Solomon Burke. The woolly mammoth went extinct at the end of the last ice age thousands of years ago, a victim of warming weather and hunting by prehistoric humans. But the mammoth, or rather something very much like it, may be resurrected if Dr. George Church has his way. The Harvard geneticist started with a close relative, the Asian elephant, and is using a genetic engineering tool known as CRISPR. Not unlike your vegetable CRISPR, I suppose, in an effort to create mammoth-like elephants capable of thriving in cold regions. It's not a vanity project. Church thinks reintroducing the mammoth-like animal into parts of the tundra could help curb climate change. And if you'd like to find out how, then you can read the rest of the article. Sean Latasore has posted it in the news section at coasttocoastam.com. See, if you like what you're hearing, you might want to check out my weekly radio show, The Conspiracy Show. It airs out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM. For more information, check out my website, strangeplanet.ca. And there's also an accompanying website for my TV show, also called The Conspiracy Show. And that's a real easy one to remember, theconspiracyshow.com, strangeplanet.ca, theconspiracyshow.com. Back to more of my conversation with John Hook, who killed Bob Crane. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. John Hook is with us, Fox TV news reporter in Phoenix, and the book, his first book, is Who Killed Bob Crane. So John Carpenter is acquitted in 1994. He passes away in 1998. You pick up the story in 2015. Where do you begin? And this is a case that's 40 years old.
Right, exactly. I need to put this out there because people are pinging me, Richard. If you want to pick up the book, go to whokilledbobcrane.com. Everything's there, and you can order it, but it's at every bookseller imaginable. So it's coming out February 21st, so thank you for that.
Excellent, and we've also linked up to that website at coasttocoastam.com.
I appreciate that.
So
thank you.
Just click on your name, and it's right there.
Get it, and I want to let them know. After the interview with Bob Crane Jr. in late March of 2015, we start searching for the evidence. This took a lot of time. First of all, the county attorney's office down here, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, I give them a lot of credit, even allowing me to do this. I asked them, does the evidence still exist? Nobody knew where the evidence was. It took months to find it. It turns out it was at the county attorney's office in their evidence room, but it took a long time to find it. There could be a couple of reasons for this. One of them was we had a freeway shooter down here that was eating up a lot of investigators' time, and I fully understand that. This wasn't high priority for them, but I said, I want to find the evidence from the Crane case, and I particularly am interested in the blood evidence and the potential for possibly retesting the DNA. The county attorney down here, Bill Montgomery, as they reviewed it, when they finally found the evidence, he said, if you can find it in there, I am not opposed to him retesting it because Carpenter is dead. If they can find any further answers than we could in a court of law, I'm all for it. As he was quoted, and he told me in an interview, I am not afraid of the truth. I give them a lot of credit because what we turned up was not it was not favorable to police and prosecutors.
Right, right. It would be embarrassing, sure.
Yeah. Let me share something with you, Richard, that I have not told many people, and I want to share it with your listeners. The original title of my book, as I got into this on the television story, I told my friend Joe Tillman, who's the photographer, that we worked together on this very closely for 2 years. I said, Joe, I got to write a book about this. There's just too much there. And that is what led to the book. The book was originally going to be titled Case Closed.
Uh-huh.
I fully believed when we tested the DNA, once we found it, that it would come back and prove that John Carpenter killed Bob Crane, that it was Crane's blood in Carpenter's car, case closed. It didn't turn out that way, Richard. It didn't turn out that way.
I'm stunned.
Well, Bob Crane's son was stunned. And when this all was unveiled on Fox 10, when we ran our story in back in November, we brought everybody, we assembled everybody in our studio. We had Bob Crane Jr., we had the prosecutor, we had the foreman of the jury, we had the investigators, we had John Carpenter's attorney in California live by satellite. When we unveiled this, I mean, it blew up on Twitter and, you know, it was everywhere. It was around the world, frankly. People are fascinated with Crane. It's still one of the top unsolved murders of all time. It consistently ranks that way.
People, John,
fascinated.
I have to ask, the evidence, I mean, after Carpenter is acquitted in 94, the case was still open, right? It was not a closed case.
Well, prosecutors felt it was closed. I mean,
they
felt that they had their guy, they put him on trial, but because the DNA in the car, in Carpenter's car, came back inconclusive, the jury and the foreman told me, and I've got a lot of this in the book, Who Killed Bob Crane, the foreman of the jury said, without that DNA, that was the big hangup. If we had had DNA that said it was definitely Bob Crane's blood in John Carpenter's car, we would have convicted him, no questions asked. But
why wouldn't a new DA come in and say, wait a minute, in 20 years, you know, DNA testing is light years ahead of where it was. Let me just go rummaging through these boxes. Let me find that blood sample. Let me run new tests. Why did it take a Fox TV news reporter to decide to do that?
There was no one to put on trial. John Carpenter had died. The guy they thought did it had died. And they had no standing. They had no case. It was basically a cold case, but they felt they had put on trial the man responsible. So they had no reason to test it. And you know, taxpayers probably would have said, well, what are you chasing down this rabbit hole for? This guy's dead. Why even, you know, they would have been only testing it to prove what they had done earlier, putting him on trial and justifying that. Well, we come along and actually we kind of did the work for him. They may have thought, hey, maybe Hook can prove what we couldn't prove 20 years ago, and it will vindicate us for putting this guy on trial. That's not what happened. What came back was a DNA profile of an unknown man, not Bob Crane, and then a partial profile that's unknown, but probably not Bob Crane either. So, I mean, we you know, and I felt, in a sense, badly about it, because I really thought that we would be able to prove this thing and probably link it to Carpenter. It just didn't turn out that way. And as a reporter, I have to report the facts and what we find. It's not what I think or believe, but what we report and what we know. And the test came back, the DNA came back, and it was not Bob Crane's DNA on that stain in the car. There are many reasons why that may have happened, and I talk about it in the book, Who Killed Bob Crane. But nonetheless, what our test results showed, not Bob Crane.
But how, after 40 years, do you ensure that the blood sample is still viable? I mean, how do you ascertain, you know, the provenance and so forth?
It was all sealed in snap cap vials. The last time it had been tested was right before trial in 1994. When they rummaged through these boxes, there are 11 boxes of evidence, and I go through it in the book. What we found, what we discovered, it was like opening a time capsule, Richard. It was a time capsule of Bob Crane's apartment. It was evidence. It was letters. It was pictures, photographs, even a mock-up of the murder weapon. Just incredible stuff that we came across. And then we came across the blood evidence. Bob Crane's file of his blood taken at autopsy, a sample of John Carpenter's blood taken when they first interviewed him in Scottsdale. They brought him back here and interviewed him. That was the first interview. And then the DNA that was on the pieces of the car cut from John Carpenter's rental car. Those were all sealed in SnapCap files. And we sent those, never opened them. We all wore gloves. It was all done by protocol. And the county attorney here actually bagged up the evidence to send it to Cellmark to test it. So we followed a chain, a protocol, to make sure that no one could later say, well, they dinked around with the evidence, this and that. We photographed everything, and we even photographed them opening it at the lab in Lorton, Virginia.
All right, let's dive into the phone calls. Let's go west of the Rockies. Frank is in Las Vegas, Nevada. Frank, good evening,
yes.
Good morning.
I used to live in Phoenix, and I worked in the county attorney's office when the Bob Crane murder case was pending. That was a case that they had various committees that would look at the case periodically. I know what the report is talking about exactly. The evidence for the Bob Crane case was kept in a basement room that was the evidence locker room of the county attorney's office. That's where they had all the videos, the equipment, and whatnot. I was surprised after I had left the office and read that they had brought the indictment. I was surprised that they had charged Carpy with the case, because it was my understanding that the Scottsdale police, although they zeroed in on him as a suspect, a person of interest, they eliminated him or moved on and actually had a theory that they believed that there were two people involved in murdering Bob Crane. A gal, a woman, that he had probably done a video of, and that she had told her lover, boyfriend, whatever. And because whoever did murder him got permission from Crane to get into his apartment or whatever. The other thing was is that it was believed that the Scottsdale police were very much in over their head, and that the crime scene, so many people had been in and out of the crime scene, the crime scene was contaminated. I was informed that Carpenter was eliminated as a suspect because he was in fear for his own life, and the, you know, that whoever murdered Bob Crane, they were going to come for him next. So I just wanted to.
Yeah, that's interesting. What you're talking about is a theory held by Carpenter's defense attorney, Stephen Avila. He believes two people were involved. And it is curious that in Carpenter's rental car, I found this interesting as well, and it cuts to Carpenter's innocence. While there's blood on the passenger door, if Carpenter, in the theory, the police theory, as you probably know, the police theory was that Carpenter bludgeoned Crane with the tripod, walked out of the apartment, made his getaway in his rental car, put the tripod against the passenger door, probably wrapped in a towel, and that's what deposited the blood on the passenger door, was the murder weapon. And then he disposed of the murder weapon or packed it up and took it back to California with him in his suitcase. It would have been small enough to do that. But why no blood on the driver's side? That was odd. That is very, very odd. And even now, very much, I have a question about it. No blood on the driver's side, nothing. Isn't that odd?
Right. In other words, if he was wielding the murder weapon, there would be, he would, and let's face it, the blood spattering would be pretty pronounced. You would think that a few droplets would end up on Carpenter's person, and
exactly,
then that would be transferred to the armrest in the car or
exactly
on the driver's side.
Yep.
Right. So you're saying that speaks to his possible
did
innocence.
He have an accomplice who had that murder weapon in the car with him? I mean, these are all things that have been thrown out there. We talked about the Kennedy assassination earlier, and I'm not kidding. There are parallels because there are as many theories as you can imagine.
Indeed. The notorious sex tapes, were any of those taken by the police?
Oh, yeah.
Did they find
And
any?
I viewed them, by the way, Richard. I viewed
Oh, dear.
some of those tapes because they still have some of them in evidence. They all depict basically the same thing. It's Crane complimenting these women. They all know they're on tape, by the way. These are the selfies of their day.
Right. It's important to know. This was consensual, and most of these women, if not all of them, knew they were being videotaped.
They did. They did. And anybody who argues otherwise, I don't buy it. I mean, these women are laughing and having a great time. Now, here's the other side of that. Some of them are drunk and intoxicated, so that's the other side of it. So that maybe doesn't rise to consent. But these women knew because the TV set was hooked up to the video camera, and they could watch it on the TV set as it was happening. They were watching themselves performing sex, and a lot of them got off on it. I'm going to be very honest about it. And certainly Crane did, but they all depict very similar scenes. He compliments them. He's Colonel Hogan, and he brings down their defenses, and they're a little wowed by the guy. And then as he starts videotaping, they seem very comfortable with it. And then, you know, Crane, interestingly enough, would edit on kind of cheesy string music underneath all these porn tapes. But they were recovered, and the porn tapes, not only do they depict Carpenter as well in some of these because they were operating together sometimes when they were out on the road, but a lot of them are Crane by himself with a woman, not with Carpenter. But it also revealed that second tripod, so there was evidentiary value in them as well.
But any of the women in these tapes, were they and their husbands or their boyfriends questioned? Did any of them fall under suspicion?
They were. They tried to track these people down. And, you know, remember, in the murder scene, there was nothing stolen from the apartment. There was nothing taken. There was no row. There was no disturbance. So the theory is that Crane let the killer into the apartment. There was no forced entry. There was no sign of a struggle. There was no sign of anybody rummaging through tapes looking for a tape of sex acts. The only thing missing was a photo album that Crane kept. And investigators believe Carpenter took it. They believe he took it on his way out of the apartment and then kind of used that as a carrot saying, you know, have you seen this this portfolio that Crane kept? But if somebody were looking for the really damning stuff, they would have wanted the videotapes. And it doesn't appear that any of that was disturbed or that anybody rifled through them looking for them.
Who else may have been, who else would have had a motive?
I think, as you said, any of these women who either were ashamed of the video being taken, maybe didn't realize it when they sobered up that it had been taken, maybe their jealous husband or boyfriend. All of those theories are possible. And the findings on our DNA test, you know, I will tell you this unequivocally. Had the prosecutors had our DNA test in 1994, I do not believe they would have put John Carpenter on trial.
All right. Hold it right there. Stay where you are, John. We'll come back on the other side. Take more questions, comments for John Hook, who killed Bob Crane. Joss Stone, Super Duper Love, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. And I will be back tonight, Sunday night, in the air chair for another episode of Coast to Coast AM, and I guess I'll keep bringing me back until I get it right. This month marks the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Los Angeles, one of the most colorful tales in all of UFO lore. Ufologist Bill Burns will join me to discuss what happened on the evening of Feb 24th, 1942, when L.A. flew into a panic as what were initially believed to be Japanese enemy aircraft were spotted over the city, touching off a massive barrage of anti-aircraft fire. And to this day, no one knows what was flying over the city, and many people believe the aircraft they saw were extraterrestrial. In the second half, memories are our most cherished possessions. We rely on them every day of our lives. They make us who we are. And yet, the truth is, they're far from being the accurate record of the past we like to think they are. Dr. Julia Shaw senior lecturer and researcher in the Department of Law and Social Sciences at London South Bank University, will join me to discuss the astonishing variety of ways in which our brains can indeed be led astray and why we can misappropriate other people's memories, subsequently believing them to be our own. That's tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, if you're a fan of Coast to Coast, I'm pretty confident you're going to love Beyond Belief, George Norrie's internet television program. You get the same great paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. And I believe it's now in its sixth season. They've produced something like 250 episodes. That's remarkable. Believe me, I know how much work goes into making a TV show. You can get started watching episodes immediately. Just visit beyondbelief.com. When we come back, your questions and comments for John Hook, who killed Bob Crane. And we are into the home stretch. Where do these last 4 hours go? I don't know, but that always happens, right? When you're immersed in a really great conversation, time just flies. And we are having a remarkable discussion with John Hook, the author of Who Killed Bob Crane, The Final Close-Up. And you can order the book from the website, whokilledbobcrane.com, whokilledbobcrane.com. John, so how did Bob Jr. and the rest of the Crane family take the news? I mean, they were, like you, were expecting this to be sort of close the file. It was John Carpenter. He's the one who did it. When the DNA test came back negative, it wasn't Bob Crane's blood in the rental car. How did they take it?
That was the hardest part, Richard, for me, because I really set out to do this for the family and for Bob Crane Jr., because I, as we talked about in the outset in the first hour, you know, the pain for him and the not knowing was still pronounced. I could feel it. I mean, anybody could, but I think as a reporter, you start to get a sense of this stuff about people. You read people. And I knew it was something that was still with him, and I wanted to settle this for him. I really did. And that was the hardest part, that I didn't get a definitive answer for them. And that was really tough. And he was great. His whole take on it, and he wrote the foreword in my book, by the way, Who Killed Bob Crane. He was gracious enough to write the foreword for the book, because he felt that the effort was worth it, and that if we got any scintilla of further evidence about what may have happened, it was worth the effort. And he said that from the outset. He said, if you can push the ball down the field even a little bit more, that would be wonderful. So he was very gracious about it and you know, wrote the foreword for my book, Who Killed Bob Crane, which is, to me, that is an ultimate compliment that he would do that. Very good, man.
Indeed. In Bob Jr.'s mind, and in the prosecutors, the police, the investigators, is there any doubt in their mind that the murderer was John Carpenter?
Prosecutors definitely believe it. The investigators definitely believe it. I asked Barry Vassell, who was there the day Bob Crane was found bludgeoned in his apartment. He was one of the first people on the scene. And then he reinvestigated it in 94. I asked him over and over in the television story, do you have any doubt? He said, I am 100% certain it was Carpenter. No doubt. Yes. Are you positive? Absolutely. I mean, there was no wiggle room. By the way, I should mention this, a couple of things. You talked about why did it take so long to get to trial in 94 after the murder happened in 78 and nothing happened. It just languished for 16 years. One of the key things, and we haven't talked about it, was the discovery of a speck of tissue in John Carpenter's rental car that was believed to be subcutaneous tissue from a skull, Bob Crane's skull. Here's the problem. They found it in a photograph when they reopened the case in 1990, 1991. They found that photograph. Jim Raines, the investigator on it, found the photograph and saw the speck of tissue in the photograph. The problem was they looked for the actual speck and it was never collected. But that speck of tissue, they said, look, if we've got blood of Bob Crane's blood type and a speck of skull tissue in Carpenter's rental car, this is game over. If they had had the actual tissue, it would have been, but they didn't. It was either lost or never collected. I believe it was collected and lost. Some people think it was never collected off that door. but it showed up in a photograph. Now that photograph became, that was a real point of contention at the trial of John Carpenter. His attorney, Stephen Avila, argued that it wasn't even tissue, and that if they don't have it, you can't consider it, which is called a Willits instruction in court of law. They gave them a Willits instruction, the jury saying you don't have to consider it if they can't produce a piece of evidence. So that was one of the reasons this took so long to get it to trial in 1994.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. John is in Cleveland. John, good morning. Hi, John, are you there?
Yes, how are you?
Hey, John.
Hi, good morning.
I've always followed this story myself and had an interest in it. And I always wondered, has Bob Crane's second wife ever been ruled out as a suspect? And is there any significance to the relocation of his remains to another cemetery?
No. They were in the middle of a divorce, actually. This is Patty, who was Fraulein Hilda on Hogan's Heroes, his second wife. During the time that this happened, yes, she was looked at because Bob Crane Jr. felt that she was a viable suspect because she had pecuniary gain. There was money at stake. And they were in the middle of a divorce. Suddenly, Bob Crane turns up dead, and obviously, you know, the wife, who's about to be the ex-wife, becomes a suspect as well. She happened to be vacationing with their 7-year-old son in Bainbridge, Washington, on the island there. There are even phone records that show that Crane spoke to her the night that he was murdered. They had an argument that people overheard. The upstairs person in the apartment overheard the argument. A one-way conversation, obviously, didn't hear her, but heard Crane arguing with his ex-wife, or about-to-be ex-wife, slamming the phone down, and then he and Carpenter went out and cruised the bars in Phoenix looking for women. During this period after Crane's murder, he was buried in a cemetery, then later moved to another cemetery right in downtown L.A. It's a really odd cemetery. And that became kind of a shrine that she pushed this agenda. Some in the family were very unhappy with that decision, but that was afterwards. So the removal of his remains and moving it to a cemetery was really to turn it into more of a shrine to her than anything. And when she died, they're both buried together there, even though Bob Crane Jr. Doesn't like that idea at all.
John, thank you for that. Jay is on the wild card line in Florida. Jay, good morning. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'll try to speak quick so I can get all this in. Wonderful to speak with you again, Mr. Sirrett, and I love the soulful, bluesy, and old-school R&B music selections you always play. I was wondering, first of all, if there was any blackmail or extortion attempts or reports involved with either Bob or John. And what I was really wondering is, with the film of Autofocus with Greg Kinnear, that, you know, depicted his fall and descent, I was wondering what the similarities and differences were of the plot points, characters, and opposed to the facts and evidence and witness testimonies that you had uncovered and came upon.
Thank you for that, Jay. A couple of things. Autofocus, Bob Crane Jr. was a consultant on that film, and so was Richard Dawson's son. Was also a consultant on that film. They tried to keep it as true to form as they could. I think the relationship between Crane and Carpenter and the hints of bisexuality, that is a very interesting, that Carpenter was bisexual, not Crane, that Carpenter may have been. That's a very interesting thing to explore and very possible. The murder, though, they depict the murder as someone coming through the Arcadia door. That's the door that led out to the pool from Crane's apartment. That door, when investigators got there that day, was locked. It does not appear anybody came in through there. And I outline in my book, Who Killed Bob Crane, that had somebody tried to enter that way in the dark that night, if somebody had a key or tried to or had left a door open and tried to get in through there, it would have been really difficult because that's where all the video equipment was. A tangle of cords and TVs and VCRs. Somebody trying to enter that apartment stealthily it would have been a nightmare, and they would have made noise, and Crane was a notoriously light sleeper. So that leaves the front door. And so in autofocus, they have the perpetrator coming in through the Arcadia door. I don't believe that. The front door is where I believe the person came in, and I believe Crane let him in willingly and then went to sleep. Because also, as I point out in the book, Crane was found in his bed in boxer shorts. If he had been with a woman, he would have been naked. He was in his boxer shorts because someone else was there, and he laid down, and many people believe, and investigators do, that Carpenter was that person in the apartment, and that Crane just laid down with his boxers on, answered the door, let Carpenter in. It was late. They were going to get some sleep, or maybe Carpenter was going to hang around the apartment until they left for the airport in the morning, and that's when the murder happened. That's what police believe.
There was a bottle of scotch in the apartment, and Crane did not drink scotch, apparently.
You know, there was gin. There was old smuggler's scotch. There was a bottle of Booth gin. A lot was made about that in an early book that was written by Gray Smith. That, you know, there were things in the apartment that just didn't make sense. Well, the booze was not there for Crane. The booze was there for the women who came over to ply them with alcohol when they wanted. It was not for him. It was for them. And then there was an idea that there were cigarettes in the ashtray. Crane wasn't a smoker. He wasn't. He wasn't a smoker or a drinker, really. He was a very light drinker. The cigarettes were primarily from Victoria Berry, who gave her statement to police in the apartment of Bob Crane. She was a chain smoker, and she was smoking like mad that day. And other people who had come over to the apartment may have been smokers. But that wasn't a big deal. That people made a lot out of that, that there were things out of place. These things really weren't. They can be explained.
Did you ever speak to members of the Carpenter family?
No, I have not. That is on my list, actually, Richard. That is on my list. His wife, I believe, is still alive, but I would like to speak with her. I have not.
You mentioned that Carpenter spent the weekend after the murder at Richard Dawson's house, who played Peter Newkirk in Hogan's Heroes. It was a great character, Newkirk.
And he had huge, remember, he was a huge star on Family Feud as well. He was the host
absolutely.
Of that for years.
Yes. You mentioned that that Dawson did not go to the funeral. Do you think there may have been some guilt there because he had introduced Carpenter to Crane?
That's a very interesting point. It's either a little bit of that he didn't want to be two-faced about it, that they weren't close, and he didn't want to just show up just on ceremony. But there's another theory that Carpenter may have told him something. That Carpenter may have, the one person he may have said something to, might have been Richard Dawson.
Took it to his grave. He took it to his grave, if that's
the possible, case. Because one of the investigators, Jim Raines, told me that Dawson threw him out of his apartment in the early 90s when he went to interview him. Not his apartment, pardon me, his home in Beverly Hills. Dawson lived pretty well, married a very big star in Britain who was kind of considered the Marilyn Monroe of Britain. He threw him out of his house, very unhappy that he was there. And they, you know, investigators, I think, had some questions about what Dawson may have known. Just a theory.
Let's grab one more call. I think we can sneak Jeff in Culver City in here on the wild card line. Jeff, good morning.
Hi, Richard. Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Hook?
Hey,
first,
Jeff.
Richard, thanks so much for your good taste in, you know, the old school Motown era music. You know, I don't know what's going on with music nowadays, but it ain't like it used to be.
You and me both.
I love it too, Richard. Good calls on all the music tonight.
Appreciate that. You can't go wrong with Stax Records.
I'm curious about the whole concept and origination of DNA technologies and applications. You know, although many researchers and forensic investigators have invested decades of their life and time into this peculiar way of identification of fathers who reject their children, people with probate or inheritance issues, and genetic, you know, issues and all that stuff. But my question is, Mr. Hook, Richard brought up an excellent point, why it took so long, 16 years, to find this Mr. Crane utilizing DNA technology, especially since the methodology of this DNA wonderment is, first of all, suspect and can be used to frame individuals
right.
by utilizing bodily fluids and all that. What's your overall assessment of this program?
It's a great point, Jeff. And, you know, as I got into the book, Who Killed Bob Crane, and really immerse myself in this, I had to learn a lot about DNA. And what I learned is DNA is not perfect. We think of it as CSI, that it is the end all and be all. It's actually starting to raise some complicated issues now in police matters. Here's why. The more you can bore in, and we had to in this case, the sample that we had been tested so many times, the original blood that was there was no longer visible. So they had to drill down into this and look at it with such a big magnifying glass, and I mean that figuratively, that you open the door of picking up outlier DNA that has nothing to do with the original crime. That is a real problem coming in DNA science. In other words, could the DNA that we picked up off the door, could it have been from the guy who constructed the door at the factory, the car door? Could it have been from an investigator who left his DNA there, from a simple touch of his finger? Could it have been from the lab, one of the technicians sneezing on it? These are the kind of things that are raised now as you're able to more sensitively pick up DNA when you go in with such a magnifying glass. You can start to pick up things that might take you down really dark alleys that don't have anything to do with the crime.
Oh, dear. Very troubling. Very quickly, and we have to say goodnight here. But what's next? I mean, are you going to pursue this? Are you going to continue and try and find out who killed Bob Crane?
We want to try to put this in the CODIS database with the FBI, what our sample found. We want to put it in CODIS, the National FBI database, and see who that DNA belongs to. So we
All right.
can maybe get a better idea.
John Hook, thank you so much for this.
Richard, thank you.
WhoKilledBobCrane.com. WhoKilledBobCrane.com. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Sean Latasor, Nathan Staten, and Donna Walker. And here in Toronto, Nathan Smith, Scott Guest, and Tom Schenck. I'm Richard Serrett. Thanks for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. So long for now.